Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping in for what is perhaps the most high-stakes immersion we've ever done. We're decoding emergency medicine.
That's right.
Our sources are this comprehensive stack of materials designed for preclinical students, which means they focus entirely on, you know, structured, rapid differentiation.
Figuring out what's knocking on the door before it's too late.
Exactly.
And our mission today is to give you that mental framework. The one clinicians use to manage time, risk, and, well, uncertainty all at once. We're not just looking at symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning how to instantly prioritize those must-not-miss conditions. This is really the shortcut to understanding the sharp edges of clinical practice.
We're essentially unpacking how structure saves lives. I mean, how do you instantly differentiate between a simple benign complaint and a genuine fatal crisis?
A great question.
So let's jump right into the first and I think most terrifying complaint, because time literally matters by the second.
Crushing chest pain. Okay, let's unpack this using the classic case. Imagine a 55-year-old man. He arrives. He's sweating heavily. He's nauseated. And he's describing a feeling like an elephant sitting on his chest.
Right.
It's radiating straight down his left arm, maybe even up to his jaw. Now, statistically, it could be something like reflux or muscle strain. Those are common.
But you can't think about that first.
You can't. Those thoughts have to take a back seat to the truly deadly causes.
Okay, so when we approach chest pain, we're dealing with all these systems that overlap. Cardiac, pulmonary, GI, vascular. What are the three conditions that absolutely have to be ruled out immediately? The ones that kill the fastest?
We call them the big three. You have acute coronary syndrome, or ACS.
The heart attack.
The heart attack. Then aortic dissection. And finally, pulmonary embolism, or PE. And our sources all emphasize that the patient's description of the pain is your fastest diagnostic tool.
Okay.
If it's that crushing, constricting pain with the cold sweat diaphoresis, you have to prioritize ACS. That suggests ischemia, a lack of blood flow to the heart muscle itself.
But the clinical picture completely changes if the patient uses a different word, right? A different descriptor.
Absolutely. 100%. If that same patient describes a sudden onset, a ripping or a tearing pain that radiates straight through to their back, your brain has to switch gears.
To aortic dissection.
Instantly. That's a tear in the inner layer of the aorta. And it's especially true if they have a history of, you know, severe hypertension or certain connective tissue disorders. A key finding on exam can be unequal pulses or a big blood pressure difference between their two arms.
And what about that third member of the deadly trio, the PE?
The PE is often defined by a different kind of pain entirely. It's pleuritic.
Meaning it hurts when you breathe?
Exactly. Mm. It hurts worse when they take a deep breath. And it's often paired with acute shortness of breath, sudden anxiety, maybe a low oxygen saturation. And if you hear a risk factor, like a recent long flight, a surgery, or just being stuck in bed for a while.
Immobilization.
Right, immobilization. That's your signal to hunt for a blood clot in the lung artery.
So if a patient has any of those red flags, the immediate workup is non-negotiable. What hits the door first?
EKG, cardiac enzymes, and a chest x-ray. You need that EKG to spot ST elevations. That's the signature for a major heart attack, and STEMI, or maybe T-wave inversions, for less severe ACS.
And the enzymes?
Troponin. That tells you if heart muscle is actually damaged. And the chest x-ray, well, it helps rule out a collapsed lung, but critically, it can show a widened mediastinum, which can be a sign of that aortic dissection.
And this is where the management just completely diverges. It's stark. Let's contrast the treatment for a STEMI versus an aortic dissection.
They are polar opposites. I mean, it's critical to get this right. For a STEMI, the mantra is, time is myocardium.
Time is myocardium.
Every minute lost means more heart muscle damage. So you start aspirin, you start blood thinners like heparin, nitroglycerin, if the blood pressure can handle it.
Okay.
All to open those vessels. And the ultimate goal is urgent PCI.
Percutaneous coronary intervention.
Getting that blockage physically opened in the cath lab, fast.
But if you give those same medications to the patient with a dissection, you could make the problem catastrophically worse.
Precisely. The source material really drills this home. In a dissection, the aorta is already tearing because of high pressure. If you give vasodilators like nitroglycerin, you can actually increase the sheer stress, the force of the blood on that weakened wall.
You could make the tear bigger.
You could propagate the tear. So the absolute priority in a dissection is aggressive blood pressure control. Use things like beta blockers to slow the heart rate and decrease the forced contraction. It's a complete reversal of priorities.
That distinction really highlights why structured thinking is everything. Okay, let's shift now. We'll move down to segment two, acute abdominal pain. This is often a true diagnostic nightmare, just because you have so many overlapping systems in one cavity.
It is, and here, localization becomes our guiding star. We have to rely on the patient's history and those four quadrants. Take the case you mentioned earlier, a 32-year-old man with severe lower quadrant RLQ pain. But the key detail, the really crucial part, is that the pain started kind of vaguely near his belly button.
The periumbilical area.
Yes, and then it migrated to the RLQ about 12 hours later. That migration is the classic textbook sign of appendicitis.
That initial pain is visceral, and then it becomes localized or somatic once the inflammation hits the peritoneum, the outer lining.
Exactly.
So location helps. RLQ makes you think appendicitis, or in a female, maybe gynecologic issues. What about the other corners?
Right. Upper quadrant, or RUQ, should immediately make you think cholecystitis, inflammation of the gallbladder, often from stones.
Yeah.
Left lower quadrant, LFQ, especially in an older patient, that screams that I have verticulitis and epigastric pain, that can be pancreatitis, or, you have to remember this, it can even be an inferior MI radiating down to the abdomen.
The major split here seems to be a surgical catastrophe versus medical management. What are the key red flags that signal an emergent surgical crisis?
We look for signs of peritonitis, a rigid, board-like abdomen, and rebound tenderness, where the pain is actually worse when you let go quickly.
Right.
That suggests a rupture, a perforated ulcer, a burst appendix. Something is broken open. But there are two vascular events that are truly terrifying. The first is a ruptured abdominal aortic aneurysm, a AAA, which presents with sudden severe pain going to the back and profound hypotension.
And the second is that classic teaching pearl, mesenteric ischemia, where the presentation is completely counterintuitive.
Exactly. The patient is writhing in absolute agony. The pain's a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
But when you press on their abdomen, it's often relatively soft.
The pain is out of proportion to the exam.
The pain is out of proportion to the physical exam. And the reason for that mismatch is so critical. The pain is purely ischemic. The gut is being strangled. It's losing blood supply. But because there isn't major tissue death or perforation yet, there's no inflammation causing that muscle guarding or rebound tenderness. It's nerve pain without the physical signs.
That's an unforgettable clinical pearl. Okay, workup. Beyond a standard CBC and metabolic panel, what are the most urgent labs and imaging we need?
You need a lipase to check for pancreatitis. And you need a lactate level. Lactate is crucial for sniffing out ischemia, like in mesenteric ischemia. A rising lactate means tissues aren't getting enough oxygen.
And for any female of reproductive age?
Mandatory.
Yeah.
A rapid pregnancy test is mandatory to rule out an ectopic pregnancy. Imaging-wise, your contrasting ultrasound, which is great first line for gallbladder and pelvic organs, versus a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis, which gives you the best detail for appendicitis and diverticulitis.
And once that surgical call is made, say, for appendicitis?
It's immediate action, NPO nothing by mouth IV fluids, IV broad spectrum antibiotics, and an immediate surgical consult. You move from possible to confirmed and get them ready for the operating room instantly.
Moving now to segment three, let's tackle the metabolic spectrum. Endocrine emergencies, specifically diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA, versus hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state, or HHS, two sides of the same high glucose coin.
They really are. And let's look at the two typical patients. You have the younger type 1 diabetic, who maybe ran out of insulin and they're vomiting and breathing really heavily.
Right.
Versus the older type 2 patient, who is just profoundly confused and has the highest glucose reading you've ever seen. The core difference here is the acidosis.
Okay, so explain that core difference. Give us an analogy to make that underlying crisis really clear.
Think of DKA as your car running out of gas and then having to burn the interior seating just to keep the engine moving.
Wow, okay.
DKA happens because of an absolute lack of insulin, usually in type 1s. This forces the body to burn fat for fuel, which produces tons of acidic byproducts called ketones. So you get high sugar, maybe 250 to 600, but the real danger is the metabolic acidosis. The pH drops below 7.3.
And that's why they're breathing so heavily.
That's the Kussmaul breathing. They're literally trying to blow off CO2 to compensate for all that acid in their blood.
So the ketones are the crisis in DKA. What about the older patient with HHS?
HHS is like having a busted fuel gauge that tells you the tank is full, so you just keep dumping more and more gas in. There's just enough residual insulin, a relative deficiency, to prevent that massive fat breakdown, so you don't get the acidosis.
Okay, so no ketones, no acid.
Right. Their pH is often normal, but their glucose levels are astronomical.
Yeah.
600, 1,000, even higher. This insane concentration causes massive fluid shifts out of the cells and extreme dehydration. That's what leads to the super high serum osmolality, and that's what causes the severe confusion and altered mental status.
The immediate management for both is systematic, the four pillars. What's step one? What's the most vital initial intervention for both DKA and HHS?
Rehydration. Step one is massive IV fluids. Both of these patients are liters and liters volume depleted. We start with normal saline, often 1 to 2 liters, fast.
And then you switch it at some point.
Yeah, you switch the fluid to D5 half normal saline when the glucose drops below 250. This is key because it prevents the patient from crashing into hypoglycemia while you're still treating the underlying metabolic chaos.
Step two is insulin, and this comes with a huge life-saving warning about potassium.
It does. It's critical. You start an IV regular insulin infusion, but the point that is drilled home by every single source is do not start insulin if the patient's potassium, their K plus AOA, is less than 3.3.
Why is that?
Because insulin drives potassium from the bloodstream back into the cells. If they're already low, starting insulin will cause their serum K plus to plummet, and that can trigger lethal arrhythmias. So potassium replacement is step three, and you have to watch it and replace it aggressively.
Finally, we talked about acidosis. The sources emphasize that DKA isn't resolved just when the glucose comes down. It's when the metabolic problem is fixed. How do we know when that is?
We know by the closure of the anion gap. The anion gap is just a calculation that tells us if there are unmeasured acids, like those ketones floating around. DKA is only resolved when that acidosis is cleared. That means the bicarb is over 18, the pH is over 7.3, and that anion gap is normalized.
So you have to keep the insulin going.
You have to maintain the insulin infusion until the ketones are gone, not just until the sugar is under control.
That's a really essential point about the anion gap. Okay, for our final segment, let's talk about two conditions defined purely by time and ischemia risk. The torsions.
Right, testicular torsion and ovarian torsion. These are true surgical emergencies where the clock is ticking. Testicular torsion is usually an adolescent male with sudden, excruciating scrotal pain. The pearl here is the absent cremastric reflex.
And what's that?
If you lightly stroke the inner thigh, the testicle on that side is supposed to elevate. If it doesn't, that's a huge red flag. It's an immediate urology consult and surgery within 6 hours, or that organ is lost.
The gynecologic counterpart, ovarian torsion, I understand, often presents more confusingly. It can mimic other abdominal issues.
It does. It's acute, severe, one-sided lower abdominal pain, often with extreme nausea and vomiting. A big risk factor is having a pre-existing cyst or a mass, which can act as a lever for the twisting. Now, Doppler ultrasound is your main tool.
To check for blood flow.
But we have to stress that a normal Doppler does not rule it out. The diagnosis is highly clinical. If you suspect it, it requires immediate surgery laparoscopic detorsion.
And of course, we have to loop back to ectopic pregnancy in any female of childbearing age with abdominal pain.
Absolutely. An ectopic pregnancy where the embryo implants outside the uterus is a time bomb. The classic triad is abdominal pain, vaginal bleeding, and amenorrhea, a missed period. If her HCG hormone level is over 1500 and the transvaginal ultrasound shows no baby in the uterus.
An empty uterus.
That is an ectopic until proven otherwise. And if that patient is hypotensive, it is an immediate crashing surgical emergency.
So this has been an incredibly structured deep dive into the high-stakes world of emergency differentiation. We covered crushing chest symptoms, the localization for acute abdominal pain, the subtle lab differences and metabolic crises.
And the overarching lesson from all these scenarios is that clinicians are trained to halt the workup and start treatment the second a patient demonstrates instability. We've seen really complex diagnoses from AAA rupture to, you know, even things like adrenal crisis masked by these very nonspecific complaints.
So let's leave our listener with one final provocative thought that ties all of this together. We've emphasized that in these time-critical scenarios, clinical decision-making often has to outpace the diagnostics. So if all the machines failed, no CT, no labs, nothing, what single finding from the history or the physical exam, across all these conditions we covered, what's the most reliable universal trigger to halt the workup and just start life-saving stabilization?
That's a great question. I would say, if you encounter a patient who is hypotensive, who is in shock, and whose blood pressure does not improve after you give them, say, 2 liters of IV fluid, that failure to respond, that is the single universal red flag.
The failure to respond to fluids.
Yes. It indicates a profound underlying catastrophe. It could be a rupture, massive bleeding, profound sepsis, endocrine failure. It doesn't matter what it is at that moment.
Yeah.
What matters is that it requires immediate, aggressive, non-diagnostic intervention.
Mm.
That is the moment where stabilizing the patient becomes the only priority.
That insight that the lack of response is the true emergency signal, that is a tremendous takeaway. Thank you for guiding us through this very high-intensity deep dive.
My pleasure.
We'll see you next time.